This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and tonight I'm joined by Fraser Hess, so this is going to be a doubly confusing show for everybody. But we have three sponsors to help us through the evening. Well, the first is Jam Software. You know them. They are the providers of enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies all throughout education and business organizations. More about them at jamsoftware.com. Secondly, by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. And they just had a big update in the store this week, so check them out again. And finally, we've got a new sponsor for this show. This episode is sponsored by XMA and the HP Chromebook 11 and 14. I'll tell you more about all of that as the show goes on. So come in, Fraser. How are you doing?
Hello, Fraser. Good evening.
This is not going to be difficult for people at all, is it? We're going to have to put it in left and right audio channels just to keep it clear.
Yes. Two Scottish people, both named Fraser. Let's see how this goes.
Yeah,
what now, could go wrong? Now, we should, for listeners, long-time listeners, we should ask how your weather is, because every time I've been on this show, your weather has been terrible.
Yeah, I mean, you're literally Noah when it comes to my weather. But in fact, today is it's wet, of course, but it's, you know, infrastructure is still working okay. So thank you for being gentle with that.
So we'll call that success.
Yes, yes. That's as much summer as we're going to get. So what's been going on since we last spoke?
So since I was last on the show, I tend to come on and talk about caching server. Mm-hmm. We've had a new version, which is only slightly new, and then we had WWDC last week, where they previewed the next version of caching server.
Okay, and one of the, we're going to talk a lot about that tonight, because obviously, well, not obviously, but in fact, this is probably, would it be fair to say, the most substantial update to caching server since it was released?
It's certainly the most substantial since, I guess, a caching server 2 that expanded it to iOS. But yeah, for the first time since iOS, this is the most, this is the biggest expansion of what it can do for end users since then.
Yeah, and I certainly feel that it's probably, certainly for iOS heavy shops, it's probably the number one reason to deploy OS 10 server in your organization by far now.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Okay, cool. Well, first of all, what did you think about WWDC overall? How did you kind of take the announcements? How did you feel about it?
It's kind of a strange WWDC for me. A lot of comparisons to last year from people. Mm-hmm. I felt a little underwhelmed, but in a good way, as in I didn't feel overwhelmed by how much it would cause me to do or need to do or... oh my goodness, I need to do that, or that's going to change a lot of my programming or that sort of thing. But at the same time, I could not believe when the keynote went on for 2 hours, 25 minutes, and at the same time, didn't feel as breakneck as last year. That's kind of strange dichotomy for me.
Yeah, it was almost like time dilated during that music section of the keynote, and it just seemed to go on and on and on, didn't it?
Plus all of the interesting things that they didn't mention in the keynote, they got cut for time. Mm-hmm. Some of which seemed more as interesting as the stuff that... so the Android Migrator, for example, that seems like a real... I mean, that's a shot across the bow. Mm-hmm. And the sort of thing that gets that kind of room of people excited and nothing was said.
Yeah, that's kind of a tanks on the lawn maneuver, isn't it? You know, to forcibly migrate. I mean, you remember we had that with the Windows to Mac migrator back in the day as well. Migration Assistant, it was called. And it can migrate from Windows to Mac, I think, can't it?
Yes, it still exists and still does it.
Still there. I haven't had a new Mac in so long, I've almost forgotten how to do that.
Does that mean you did not buy the new MacBook?
I did not, no, not yet, because I couldn't find MD to buy my MacBook Air. So if MD listening wants to buy a 13-inch MacBook Air... Oh, this is the most Scottish thing ever, just try to sell things on the podcast.
Oh, I haven't got started.
Right, so talk us through the server side of WWDC. I mean, what is OS 10 server shaping up to look like for the next year?
So last time I was on, I talked about OS 10 server 4.0 and the changes, and I guess we should list in the show notes my previous two interviews with Bradley, where we go over a whole bunch of other OS X server and caching server stuff. OS X Server 4.1 has come out. The main difference is that it makes it easy to deploy in an enterprise with a Windows DNS server. That's really the only change in for caching server that's of consequence. And in the meantime, I've come out with two products of my own related to caching server. The first is a product called CacheWarmer, which has been out for a couple of months now, and we're in schools, and in fact some places a school district or two, and also working with a large retailer here in the US to deploy, who have a Mac Mini in every store doing caching server.
Okay. So it's really getting some traction, the caching server, and then obviously CacheWarmer as well.
Yeah, so it's nice to see, and actually it has done the rounds amongst Apple pre-sales engineers as well. So I think that's partly how the word is getting out with that. But it's also nice to see that they are pushing caching server into large organizations with big iPad deployments and so on.
Yeah, you can see how it's, apart from this app thinning thing that's coming out in iOS 9, the fact that iOS apps I've clearly seen that gotten bigger and bigger and bigger over the years with more resources and Retina resources and stuff. It's starting to become a real, well, not a real bind, but for people who are more bandwidth constrained than I am, it can be an issue, particularly in schools where you try and hit a lot of them at once. A lot of updates are running through app installations at the same time or whatever.
One thing I've learned about retail, and I think it somewhat applies sometimes in schools, is that in retail, where the margins are very small, mm-hmm. they want to have the internet, but they want to have it at the lowest possible price, and that usually means the lowest possible speed.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and the lowest possible monthly cap and things like that as well.
Right.
Yeah. Capping is a whole other discussion. I remember having conversations with friends in South Africa about that, where a lot of schools and homes are capped, and they were one school I spoke to, they were sending iPads home with the kids, but then the iPads were downloading iOS updates at night and burning through people's data caps on their home broadband as well. And there were some complaints about that to be had as well.
Don't you think that's also an argument for holding back updates with MDM?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's coming in iOS 9 is the ability to push, to prompt the device through MDM to download its update. So that may be something you could do on a rolling basis during school days or something like that. I don't know if there's controls to have it not happen at other times, but certainly you can prompt it at certain points. So you can maybe prompt one class at 9 in the morning and one class at noon and then another class the next day at 9 and so on.
So the other thing that I've worked on since I was last on is a book that is in the iBook store called Unboxing Caching Server. Mm-hmm. It's a deployment guide. And mm-hmm. so it's just a kind of, A to Z, front to back, on everything you would need to know to successfully deploy caching server. This was actually made in iBooks author. And I don't know if you've talked about in the show how iOS 8.4 is reported to bring iBooks author textbooks down to the iPhone. They've only worked on the iPad previously.
Yeah, I think we mentioned that briefly a couple of shows back when that news came out. When iOS, I think the first 8.4 beta kind of made that public knowledge. So it'll be interesting to see just how they do that, because obviously iBooks author has kind of been iPad focused for so long, but it's clearly with the things like iPhone 6 Plus, you're starting to get pretty close to iPad mini territory. So it'll be interesting to see how much work they do in the book to bring it down to the smaller size.
Yeah, I'm also interested to see if there's a new iBooks author or anything that's required of authors to resubmit their book or reformat it for the iPhone.
Yeah, now your book requires a software update as well. Welcome to the future.
My book's already had two software updates.
Yeah, well, I suppose when you're doing tech writing, you're always been at the mercy of software cycles. Okay, so where are we going next with this?
Yeah, so let's talk about OS X Server 5, for mm-hmm. which the preview came out last week at WWDC. Mm-hmm. I think the first big difference for OS X Server 5 is that it's going to run on both Yosemite or Mac OS X Yosemite and Mac OS X El Capitan. So mm-hmm. this is the first version of OS X Server, I think, that we could say ever, that's going to run on two different versions of the OS.
Yeah, because previously the server product was locked to the same version of the operating system as it shipped with.
Yes. Well, when it was an operating system in and of itself, it carried the all the client side features, and then
and once $1,000 price tag.
Yeah, when and once it became a standalone $20 application, it was still tied to a single operating system. So once you upgrade, you'll be able to upgrade to OS X Server 5 without upgrading to El Capitan, which is potentially maybe a lot less risky.
Yeah, and I suppose it should also have the benefit of getting the caching server features out there for more people sooner. Because I imagine that upgrading your server app versus upgrading your whole OS is something that more people might consider. I mean, I know that my OS X server machine has been on Mavericks until... recently what happened was there was an Apple Configurator update that I needed to use for a version of the iOS, and that was only running on Yosemite, so I had to go... I was kind of forced to upgrade to Yosemite to do that, but I had kept on Mavericks for the whole year.
And Apple Configurator is also one of these products where they tended to have tied operating system upgrades in and forced you up.
Yeah, both on the Mac OS and the iOS version that it was installing, and that was exactly what made me have to upgrade, was because I wanted to... I think it was iOS 8.3, actually. I had to restore some devices that were to go to iOS 8.3, and the only way to do that was Configurator 172, I think it was. So it was one of those kind of trapdoor upgrade situations.
Right. So two more little thoughts on this. It's possible that OS X Server 5 could be a free upgrade, because why would they offer two different versions of OS X Server on Yosemite?
Yeah. So you would then see two products in the store or different versions, and you know, there would be one Server 5 for Yosemite, one Server 5 for El Capitan if they weren't essentially the same product.
Right. Yeah. And my last piece of speculation there is that it could be out before El Capitan because it's supported on Yosemite.
So that could ship separately. That would be interesting.
Well, it could also be interesting because then you could probably cache El Capitan on the existing version, but that could be an interesting... Now, it does require 10.10.4.
So that's a window in there, isn't it?
Yeah, so there could be some support that's coming in 10.10.4 on Yosemite for that. We'll need to wait and see, or it could just be, well, we're not going to support the older versions. Of course, we understand the networking stack is getting a big upgrade in 10.10.4.
Yeah, maybe that's what they're waiting for, is a stable networking stack to ship this new software. So they don't get a lot of false positive bugs, I don't know. But that would be one nice thing for schools for that in that situation would be that you could probably roll out the new iOS caching server in advance of iOS 9, which might be to some benefit for people who are maybe... Because one of the things in this new caching server is the idea of keeping some personal data in there as well, and that might speed some backups and restores around about the iOS 9 launch.
Yeah, and not just in advance of that, but because it's in advance of El Capitan, you know, you're upgrading from, say, 10.10.4 or 10.10.5, where it's been made much more stable, to 10.11.0, which we would expect to be less stable. And so rather than just putting in 10.10.10.11.0 and crossing your fingers and hoping that everything is going to be great, then you could just say, okay, we're going to run OS X Server 5 with its new functionality, but, you know, we're not going to touch, you know, the major operating system version underneath it.
When you think about the bandwidth requirements for a rollout for iOS 9 and El Capitan, I wonder how much money, actual cash money, caching server is worth to Apple. Like, how much does it save them in bandwidth to have, you know, one copy going down to the client and then the client distributing it themselves rather than Apple having to serve out every copy?
Yeah, it will depend, of course, on the size of deployments. I mean, even at home, I get about a 2-to-1 ratio in terms of my own bandwidth savings. I don't know. I mean, that doesn't translate into cash money for me because I just have a certain, you know, I have no cap and I have a certain amount of bandwidth from the ISP. But when you're doing that over and over and over again, that will add up.
Yeah. Most definitely. So, yeah, fingers crossed on that one. I think it's potentially a very interesting upgrade and one that I think a lot of schools are going to want to deploy? I mean, I'm hearing more people ask me about it now. People come to visit the school, they are becoming aware of this thing called caching server. I think a lot of resellers are mentioning it, like you said, Apple pre-sales people, but also outside of the US, resellers are talking about it as well. And I guess resellers probably see it as an opportunity to sell a Mac along with an iOS deployment, which will give them better margins as well. And to be fair, I mean, these guys have got to make their bones as well. You know, and that's one way that they do that, is to sell things like Apple TV and a Mac for configurator and things alongside what, quite honestly, most schools want an iOS deployment now. You know, I spoke to one reseller abroad, not in the UK, but abroad, where they said that iOS was something like 98% of their education business and the Mac was about 2%.
Well, it's a better fit. Let's just say that.
I would say it is certainly for schools coming to Apple products, you know. There are also schools that have been on Apple products for a while. Some schools, more in the US than in Europe, I would say. And they're perhaps a little more ambivalent about which platform they're going for. But schools new or coming back to Apple are overwhelmingly going iOS.
So let's talk about the big new feature in caching that's been announced. And that is that caching in OS X Server 5 is going to support the caching of personal iCloud data.
Okay. And the definition of personal iCloud data includes?
Includes things like iCloud Drive data, data stored by applications using CloudKit, iCloud Photos. And that's, I think, as much as I know of that at the minute.
Okay.
So I'm guessing this almost certainly requires iOS 9 on the device side.
Probably, yeah. Is it clear yet whether or not it's going to cache data on the way out and the way back in? So, you know, if you're running a backup to iCloud, for example, of a device, is that backup data going to be cached on the way out? Or is it going to be sort of preemptively warmed up, if you like, on the way in?
So they use the term preheat in the WWDC session.
Okay.
But in general, caching server doesn't preheat anything so far. And I guess the bottom line is I don't know. Backup data has not been described in any of the sessions or documentation as something that it does. The use case that they describe is users with multiple devices on the same network. So if you make changes to a Keynote file, which is stored in iCloud Drive, on your iPad, that then shows up on your iPhone.
Okay, so
via caching server rather than going back out to iCloud.
Okay.
That's the sort of scenario.
Yeah.
I mean, the documentation makes it sound like the whole thing is opt-in, and right now the first beta of OS X Server 5 doesn't have any UI for that.
Okay.
Have you seen anything on the phone or the iPad that you're running iOS 9 on that makes it seem like there's an iCloud caching or acceleration option?
Nothing that I can see so far, no.
Okay.
Possible it's not there, or possible that it's just the opting in part is not there yet.
Yeah. Because I'm actually wondering how this thing scales. So how many hundreds of gigabytes do you have in iCloud Photos?
About 350.
Right, so... Yeah. So, you know, when you and your colleagues and some of your students are doing that sort of level of iCloud Photos, you know, you're gonna crush your caching server with data that isn't really getting reproduced to a lot of devices.
Yeah, it's going to be, I mean, the first load of iCloud Photos was enormous. You know, it took multiple weeks to finish. But for people who've not used iCloud Photos, one of the features of it is that the photos that you haven't accessed on your device are sort of optimized away to ever smaller versions, down to tiny thumbnails, and then they're brought down again as soon as you use them. So, you know, whether or not that is going to be rapidly accelerated or not, I'm not sure. I presume, you know, for example, a video, right? You shoot a big video on your phone, it's going to go into caching server and then to iCloud, and then you might find it quicker on your Mac and on your iPad, because that video is just coming back from local store.
Right, so I can see this working really well in residences, where, you know, you've got your Mac and your iPhone and your iPad, and they're all yours, and maybe, you know, your wife has a set of those. But when you then scale that up to, you know, 20 staff and 100 students are, you know, are higher and higher and higher, is how much storage do you need before this becomes really feasible?
Yeah.
And bear in mind that Apple doesn't ship any server hardware.
Yeah, you're going to just look at, I mean, we're running our caching server on a Mac Pro, which has 4 drive bays, but of course, even today, the Mac Pro doesn't have 4 drive bays anymore.
I was going to say, we're talking about an old cheese grater Mac Pro, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it's going to be important, I think, to really have some people profile the behavior of caching server over in this new world and see exactly how, you know, large sets of data traveling out of your network and back into your network, and how long does it hang around, how much is actually there, and the behavior of backups as well. Because I think from what you're describing there, it seems to me like if that was, you know, if you're a building of 150 students, each of whom have one device, mm-hmm. you're going to be putting a lot of data into your caching server for almost no perceptible benefit whatsoever.
Yeah, unless it was used on a wipe and restore. But even as far as I know, this hasn't been fixed yet, is when you do an iCloud restore and it mm-hmm. starts downloading all of the apps, I think yep. it's still going to the App Store for those and not the caching server.
Even if they're in your caching server, just
yeah,
even,
well, even though probably, I mean, support. It's a restore, so probably most of the apps are in the caching server.
Yeah. Wish it would, because one of the sort of continuing issues with iCloud backup and restore is what happens if one of the apps is gone from the store. You just don't get it back.
That still might be an issue with the caching server, because yeah. you still have to check into the store before you can use the cache.
Mm-hmm. So it has to still be a live SKU.
I guess so.
Yeah, something like that.
So yeah, even 100 people who are using the 5 gigabytes of free space, I mean, that's a half terabyte if they were to all fill that or get close to it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I think, I'm guessing there's going to have to be some kind of kill switch on the server to say we're not going to store this stuff. Now, there shouldn't really be a privacy issue with it, because encryption keys for this are stored on the device, and it's stored encrypted both over the air and on the caching server itself.
Yeah, so there's nothing really recoverable from the caching server disk, even if you were to acquire it somehow, in theory.
Yes.
Unless you're the NSA. Sorry, spies, I know you're listening. Pretend I didn't say that.
The other feature announced of caching server that's is that it supports this app thinning and on-demand resources. Mm-hmm. So did you talk about that on your previous episode?
Yeah, we talked about on-demand resources a little bit last episode, and one of the concerns I raised, and I'm glad you've kind of addressed it already, is what on earth happens if you are the first teacher of the school year to do a lesson with GarageBand with your kids, and GarageBand tries to suck down, 100 megs of on-demand resources to 30 iPads, and your network goes into meltdown, and that's your lesson gone. So if caching server is available to pre-position some stuff and also do on-demand resources, I think that's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, so just to put this in context for listeners who don't understand, is that previously on iOS, when a developer uploads an app to the App Store, they're uploading everything that anybody on any device type might need. And it's just this one artifact that that the App Store gets, and that the end user's device gets eventually. And now they're going to actually take that artifact that the developer uploads and kind of cut
pull it.
Pull
apart, basically.
Yeah, pull it apart and then kind of put it back together to meet the demands of, or the device characteristics of the device it's ending up on. So an iPod Touch 4th generation is going to get something very different from a Retina iPad Mini.
Mm-hmm. Although here's the question, right, with this new split screen business. Mm-hmm. An app that exists on an iPad Air 2 may at times be behaving like an iPhone app and other times behaving like an iPad app. So you might end up having to deliver more resources. Or not more resources, but less, more than the absolute minimum for the particular device hardware if that app is going to participate in multitasking.
Yeah, I think they described three ways that they might cut it, and that is different processor architectures. So we have 32-bit iOS devices and 64-bit iOS devices. And then what you were just saying, iPhone resources and iPad resources. So, in one sense, the iPhones are never going to get the iPad resources.
Yeah.
If that gets downloaded. And the third way they said is, normal images, retina images, and the 3X images for the iPhone 6 Plus.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think the thing that this signals to me that is terrible is, does this mean that we have another year of Apple delivering 16 gig devices? If they're inventing and shipping technology in 2015 to address space concerns.
Storage pressure, yeah.
Yeah.
So if you think about what have they delivered in order to do that, you've got iCloud Photo Library, you've got app thinning, you've got on-demand resources, you've got smaller iOS updates as well.
Yeah.
I agree with you. It almost feels like they're doubling down on small devices. It really does.
Yeah, it feels like they're using software to address it in large part.
I saw an advert today. I was in the supermarket, and there was a poster up that said, the phone you want at the price you want to pay, and it was an 8 gigabyte iPhone 4S. And I was like, that is not the phone anybody really wants.
I even got my mother to get a 64 gig iPhone this last time because you like to use the camera. And also she's partial to letting my son use it, and he loads games on it. So then those are enormous. The on-demand resources bit is slightly different in that it is the example they keep using is game levels. So you may never need all 20 levels of a game or something if you only ever get to level 2 and throw it away, or can't get past level 2 or whatever the case may be. And then you never actually download the rest of the levels, or you never need the rest of the levels, so you don't download them until later. So it'll be interesting to see how caching handles this. For example, does it get the entire app with all of the parts of it, or does it have a different asset for every on-demand resource and every piece of app thinning that it has to deal with?
Yeah, because that if it gives you different bundles, pre-cut bundles in different ways, you could really blow up your storage space on the cache again.
Right. That's what Apple do on their end, or what they might be doing on their end, is they're saying, well, we'll handle this on the server side and reduce the storage on the device side.
Which is fine. I think as long as it works, and B, as long as it's reliable, it would be a shame, I think, it's not clear to me, I guess, what I'm trying to say is, it's not clear to me what triggers your device getting the new components. And that scenario I mentioned about, being the first teacher to hit a particular feature with a class and then requiring an ODR download. Can that be pre-positioned? Can you make that speed up? Or can you force the device to load more than it really needs?
Yeah, and I'm also not clear in which scenarios an existing device gets a thinned app. So probably on a software update, probably on a restore but my guess is that if you have a 16 gig device and you really wanted everything to be thinned out, you might have to do a restore in order to get thinned
the apps from the app store.
Because you've already got an existing app, and if there's nothing for it to do, where's the mechanism to say, and I would like Facebook to be smaller? And so on.
Yeah, I suppose in principle, when you do a sort of update an app, you're essentially at the moment getting a whole new version of the binary. So they could just send down a smaller package and do the package replacement that way.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a case. And I think when you're loading an app from scratch, you'll get it. But if you're already constrained and you manage to upgrade to iOS 9 within your constraint, I don't think anything, I don't get the impression that anything is going to automatically happen. And I also don't know if the developers need to do anything either. Do the developers need to resubmit under the iOS 9 SDK, for example?
Possibly. So, there might be new tagging in the bundle or something like that.
Or, but yeah, and with and therefore with Xcode 7.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, well, that's a solid overview of what is coming. I think a lot of schools are going to be interested in that. There are many, many wins to be had with caching server already, and certainly with what's coming in the next version, I think it's going to be even bigger again. I want to take a minute and tell you about Jam Software. Jam Software provide ICT staff with these enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in education. And now with this app, Casper Focus, they've placed these technologies right into the hands of teachers who work with students every day. So what Casper Focus lets teachers do is it allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention. They can lock the device to a specific application, so you can use that to conduct a secure exam, for example. You can also initiate AirPlay straight from the teacher's device, so it's not just that you have to ask the pupil to start AirPlay, you can actually just start it for them. Particularly good for younger pupils, actually. There's plenty of other things. You can also use it to distribute iBooks to devices and look at the battery status, for example, and also clear the passcodes of the devices that are in your class. So you can learn what else you can do with Casper Focus at jamfsoftware.com, jamfsoftware.com, and we really thank them for their continued support of Out of School. Cool. So let us talk about security.
All right.
It's not been a good week for security.
No, it's been a pretty bad week.
When is it ever a good week for computer security these days?
Good point.
So what happened? What the particular Apple thing that happened? I mean, you know, there was the OPM hack, which was horrendous in itself. But the one that's relevant to Apple people in particular.
Yeah. So yesterday, a group of researchers, who I think, I'll just double check this, I think mostly at the University of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, we can trim this.
Smart speed will get it.
So yesterday, a group of researchers, four of whom were at the University of Indiana and then Georgia Institute of Technology, and put out a paper that, if you only read the abstract, is incredibly scary in terms of vulnerabilities on OS X and in iOS. And what they were trying to do and pose in their paper was, does the app sandbox model that iOS and the later OS X have really work when it got pressed against?
Mm-hmm. And they were able to demonstrate quite a number of paths in which they could defeat that sandboxing. Is that right?
Right. So they demonstrated, I think, four ways in which you could get out of or do something that you shouldn't be able to do in a sandboxed app. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there are a few minor issues with it. They keep using the term Apple Store, which we know to be a retail store, instead mm-hmm. of App Store throughout. They capitalized the term Mac, which is short for Macintosh and not the media access control. And there's a misnomer about Gatekeeper that came out in that paper that I've seen repeated. But these issues aside with it, the vulnerabilities seem to be genuine. I've watched all the videos. I've read the whole paper and not just read the reporting on the paper.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's an upside to this, or it's not as bad as it initially sounds, which we'll get to.
Okay.
Do you want to go into the details of each of them, or just go over what they are?
It's probably just worth going over what they are, and
okay.
Just to kind of know the areas of vulnerability in the system.
So on OS X, they demonstrated a vulnerability with Keychain where a malicious application can create a Keychain item and then use that item once another application, a legitimate application, puts a password in it to steal a password or an authentication token.
Okay. So you have to have a malicious app installed first, and then that is aping the keychain contents of a legitimate application, and then have that legitimate application overwrite
Yeah, correct? Yeah. So it could say I'm creating an internet password, which is the sort of thing that Safari and Chrome use, and then actually not put the password in there. But when Safari and Chrome come along, they've been preemptively given permission to use that item by the malicious application, and it then Safari publishes the password in the keychain, but the malicious application still has access to the keychain item and can then read the password back out of it and do whatever it likes with it. One of the scarier pieces of this was that in all four of these cases, they managed to upload but then immediately delete. They managed to upload and get approved and then immediately delete applications containing these malicious actions to the Mac and iOS app stores.
And that is a genuine concern.
Right.
More broadly.
The second vulnerability was a vulnerability called that they called container cracking, where a helper application inside bundled inside a Mac App Store application was able to ape, to use your word, or pretend it was Evernote and break out of its sandbox into Evernote's sandbox and pull out notes and authentication tokens, I believe.
That's pretty horrifying.
I think that one could actually be on the App Store side, that one could actually be taken care of almost entirely by automated software, and it doesn't require human review. So I think the historical reason why they don't check bundle identifiers that exist in helpers and frameworks inside of Mac App Store applications is because frameworks can be shared across applications. But frameworks are only loaded into other executing code. They don't run an executable themselves. So that's okay by itself because frameworks don't get any additional access to bundles or containers, sorry. But helper applications, things like login items or XPC services or Today extensions, those all run their separate processes, and that was what they used. So they could introduce a check that said, you know, please check this against any other known bundle identifier in the Mac App Store and see if there's a conflict there, and then, you know, immediately deny it or reject it. Because it may not be known to folks, but when developers upload to both the iOS and the Mac App Store, there is a series of automated validations that happen to that app. And these days it's things like, you know, making sure that you don't have any per PC code in your application or that you do have 64-bit code and that sort of thing. So, and those checks all happen before it reaches a human reviewer, and you can get rejected pretty much immediately for those sorts of violations. So it could be something like that could head that off. Maybe not entirely, but at least it would be a process improvement and a countermeasure.
Okay, so that's 2 out of 4. What else have we got?
Right, so far we've only been talking about OS X. And now here's where they found some stuff on iOS as well. There's a vulnerability that they called WebSocket IPC interception, and this is where, say, an extension, such as a browser extension, talks back to another application. And it's possible for a malicious application to, if they get the timing right, get in line and receive messages from the extension. So the example that they're throwing around, which isn't, I would say, entirely fair, is that they managed to get passwords that 1Password was trying to save in a 1Password vault.
Okay, so this is where There's something embedded in the browser that is talking to another process on the Mac.
Yes.
So a non-example, if you like, would be for possibly like the Pocket extension, mm-hmm. where the Pocket extension, the browser actually talks directly to Pocket's website, and Evernote does the same, I believe, rather than talking to the equivalent app on the Mac.
Right.
Or on the counter example.
Yeah, or on the iOS device.
Right.
This vulnerability also was demonstrated on iOS. The main problem here, and also the solution, is that both sides need to be able to authenticate that they're connecting to something legitimate and that they're being connected to by something legitimate, and who they expect to be connected by.
So you're almost talking about a firewall between processes on your...
No, more of signed messages or some level of authentication that, yes, this is, if I opened up this WebSocket to have my extension talk to me, then I need to verify that it is, in fact, my extension that's talking to me, without that being discoverable by the... by an
That's
attacker.
A very hard security problem overall, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
Not impossible, but quite difficult in terms of the user experience. You know, you do these kind of things with, is this Bluetooth device that is connecting to me the actual keyboard in front of the user? So type in this number that you see on the screen. I mean, we do that with Apple TV and things as well, but doing that, between two things on your own computer seems very annoying in terms of user experience.
Right, given that it has to be
done every time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the last one, where I think iOS suffers more, is that applications can, and malicious applications can hijack URL schemes or third-party URL schemes and pick up authentication tokens and other things. So I think one of the examples was you go into the Pinterest app, you say you want to sign in with Facebook, and then you go over to Facebook and get an authentication token, but when it calls back to Pinterest, a third-party application has actually picked up the callback and is getting the authentication token rather than the Pinterest app getting it.
So this is an application maliciously registering to handle a URL scheme that it shouldn't actually handle.
Right.
And it basically belongs to someone else.
So right now, any developer can register any URL scheme that they want. And on the Mac, the first application to do so wins. On iOS, the last application to do so wins in a conflict, and which is perhaps why it's worse on iOS.
Because you could have installed the Pinterest app, and then weeks or months later you could install another app that silently registers for that URL scheme, and you would never know it until you were bitten by it.
Yeah. So again, on the App Store review side, there could be more checking to say, okay, who is registering for what, and maybe some process of uniquing those out.
Mm-hmm.
Or
including the bundle ID and the URL scheme or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, it becomes really cumbersome, but nobody cares because the user never sees that.
Right. I mean, if you remember the beginning of the App Store, and it seemed like people were maliciously going in and registering the bundle IDs and application names of popular applications, which were otherwise, unused and, at least protected by common law trademark.
Mm-hmm. Something I had to get sorted out.
So some of these seem kind of scary. People taking authentication tokens and passwords and getting into your private Evernote notes and that sort of thing. Here's what I see that is, potential mitigation and the upside.
Okay.
All of these attacks are targeted.
Okay.
So you've got to say, you've got to go after a particular keychain item or a particular container or try to intercept a particular app's, WebSocket or URL scheme.
You can't just hoover up data from the entire device en masse.
Yeah, especially, you could hoover up some data in the keychain. You could do it because you can just sit there and make keychain items until the cows come home. But mm-hmm. If you're doing container cracking, you can only crack one container with a given app simultaneously. And with the URL scheme, you've got to publish all those URL schemes before you upload to the iOS App Store.
Yes, you can't actually change that on the fly.
Yes.
It's not a kind of botnet situation where somebody could send down new URL schemes to register.
It's a fixed part of the app.
Yep.
You've got to convince a user to install a malicious application. Mm-hmm. So in all likelihood, in order to do that, you would have to give them an application that provided some kind of value. We'd have to see how that worked out. And in almost all the cases, they need to run preemptively.
So you have to have launched that application in advance of the attack.
Right, yeah, they need to run in advance. So if you've already got a Facebook password in your keychain, they can't get at it. But if you run the malicious app preemptively before you, create a Facebook keychain item, then that would be a problem if it was indeed trying to hack Facebook passwords. But again, it's going to hack a particular, kind of website or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also worth mentioning that so Apple on OS X have a malware detection and removal scheme, which has been around since Snow Leopard, mm-hmm. and that was not tested. As a result of them pulling their apps from the App Store, at the moment that they were approved, that didn't get tested. And also, Apple have a mechanism inside the App Store to revoke developer certificates, and that is also not tested by this.
Yeah, because the researchers essentially didn't go that far.
Right,
they stopped the experiment before Apple could swing those into action, if you like.
So. But on the other hand, there's multiple layers of defense that have been broken here, most importantly, including app review. And that's most important because App Store apps are meant to be trusted.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the fundamental things about iOS in particular, and certainly Mac App Store as well, is that is an absolutely safe place to go and install software. That's why the entire app economy exists, I think, is because the App Store is, for the first time in computing history, a safe place to install third-party software without destroying your machine. And this is, not a complete violation of that trust, but certainly a dent in the armor. One might argue is a violation of that trust entirely, but fortunately it hasn't gotten that far.
Right. This vulnerability in Keychain, they wrote that they reported to Apple on October 15th. So we're now at the time of recording, we're at like 8 months and 3 days. And no word from Apple, and they've waited 6 months after Apple asked them to in order to publish this, and I don't believe even up to the time of recording that there's been any word from Apple on when they intend to fix this or what they intend to do about any of these vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm. I've certainly not heard anything either. And that is, I suppose for me, that's one of the major areas of concern is this has been open a very long time. And I kind of feel like Apple's ecosystem is a little bit tightly coupled right now. So, to ship fixes to things requires shipping fixes to a lot of things,
Right. And we talked about, the decoupling, fortunately, of OS X server from the rest of the OS, which was good. But on the other hand, we had WWDC just last week, and we're talking about 10.11 and iOS 9, and there wasn't anything, as far as I know and I can tell, that was like, and in we're making some changes to the keychain, and here's how it will affect you. And mm-hmm. I mean, that was a platform for getting that sort of word out.
Yeah.
and saying, well, you know, we do know about this and we are going to fix it, and it is going to mean
changes for you, the developer.
Changes for developers and how they, you know, access Keychain, or this is now the best practice for accessing Keychain, or that kind of thing. According to the post that AgileBits, the maker of 1Password, put out, they had this vulnerability reported to them in November 2014, so a little bit later, but that there's nothing that they can do because there's no mechanism inside this browser extension to validate the connection at the other side.
This is like something the platform could potentially offer at some point.
Yeah. And I think the worst thing that got written in the entire report was that in terms of this class of vulnerabilities, what they're calling cross-application resource access. XARA. Zara, maybe?
Zara.
I haven't heard it said, so. Yeah. is that Android may do better on this front. Than the Mac or iOS, which is just kind of hang your head in shame time. So,
yeah, it's one of these things. It's very frustrating. There's always going to be vulnerabilities in software. Well, I say always, you know, that's a pessimistic view, but I think it's very, very, very difficult to provide completely secure software. However, having the organizational capability of shipping fixes in a prompt fashion, I think, is something that has been shown to be lacking in the story. And that is more concerning to me, I think, than the existence of a specific bug, you know.
Right. And I mean, do you remember the go-to fail bug, which, I mean, I don't think there was a better, more aptly named bug. So the bug was to do with, I think, like SSL or certificate validation, and so somebody could present an invalid certificate and it would pass because of this bug. And I look at that and I go, you know, these things are deterministic, right? Where are the unit tests that say, you know, here's a perfectly valid certificate, does it pass? Here's a certificate that is invalid because it's expired, does it pass? And so on. And then, you know, that's kind of a moving target because certificates do expire and you would have to do some maintenance on that. But that's exactly the sort of code where, you know, 5 minutes after it gets checked in, somebody should know that we've now got a failing test or we've now got six failing tests or whatever it should look like. And so sort of thing worries me in that sort of cases. There's a security vulnerability that I think automated tests would have gone a long way to finding.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, one of the in small amount of defense in some of this stuff, I think probably it's fair to say that quite a lot of applications depend on this documented behavior to work correctly. You know, this ability to share things through Keychain and various things like that, helper applications and so on. And if Apple was just to slam the door and a lot of that stuff, a lot of things would break immediately. Does that seem fair to say?
I think that's fair to say on the Keychain one. Yeah. I think borrowing another app's container bundle or a container ID is
not so much.
Is something that, like I said earlier, could be automated. There could be automated checking of that in the review process.
The URL scheme stuff, I mean, there's a whole cottage industry of apps.
Right.
Using URL schemes into other apps on iOS.
Yes, that, and I mean, the fact that that isn't, I mean, that those things on iOS may be there because there isn't a better solution like there is on Android and Windows Phone for, hey, I'm an app and I expect to be called this way and do these things and you can call me to open this type and you know, the whole intent scheme and that sort of thing. So yes, that has that. So out of that, you know, people use what they have and make it work, right? And so, you know, we used URL schemes and passed stuff around, you know, essentially unencrypted inside the phone. So and unsigned and unchecked.
Yeah, when you say it out loud like that, You sort of realise, okay, yeah. Let me break in here and tell you about Shobi. Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect and review student work on their iPads and then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes and voice notes right onto their documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible applications or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email and push notifications. Now, the way this works is that Shobi Basic is completely free and teachers can try it out with their students in just a few minutes. You get started by downloading the Shobi app from the App Store or visiting shobi.com. That's shobie.com. And there's a special offer for admins listening to this podcast. You can buy Shobi Pro for 5 teachers and they'll upgrade an extra 5 teachers to Shobi Pro for free. That's a total of 10 teachers and all their students on Shobi Pro for a full year. Visit shobi.com/outofschool for details. Right, so do we want to move on?
Yeah, I think we can.
You had some sort of questions for me, some things you were interested in talking about this show.
Well, yeah, and we talked about this before all the vulnerability news came out that we wanted to talk about. But I didn't know I thought it might be interesting for listeners to hear more about your background and all the things that, you know, Cedars have gone through to get where you are today. I know you tell the iPad story out there a lot, but
I suppose we kind of tell the tip of the iceberg story, which is the bit you see above the water line, which is, you know, this was a school who went one-to-one iPad first, as far as we know, the first school in the world to do that on a whole school basis. But I suppose, and I've increasingly been seeing this more and more as time goes by, sort of the bit that you don't see, the bit under the waterline is actually massive, you know, and in many ways that is what enables or did enable a lot of the transition that we did from being a very traditional lab-based school to being a one-to-one mobile device school. Yeah. So, yeah, you can tell some stories about that.
Yeah, and I mean, knowing you a wee bit better, the one of the things I think I've seen is that one of the reasons you were able to pull it off, you know, being that first iPad one-to-one school was that you were right there ready for it to happen. And so when it did happen, that's why it was able to come together. Because if somebody just seen the iPad and thought, oh, well, you know, maybe we could give a couple of those to students. It's like, no, you were like, you know, 3 steps into the process as a school. And then going, oh, yeah, that... we've got this idea and the iPad just slots right into the middle of that hole in our idea perfectly.
Yeah. I mean, I had been personally looking for the next generation, the sort of post laptop device for about 5 years, possibly a little bit longer, maybe 6 years. And really, you know, I was mentioning this on Twitter recently, I found an old presentation on my Mac recently and it was entitled The Things We Didn't Buy. And I never gave that presentation anywhere, but I think I wrote it as a draft for something and then I threw the idea out and did something else for a certain event. But it was really interesting to look back at that presentation and sort of think about some of the trends in educational technology that have come and gone over that period. And I think, you know, the first thing that was in that presentation was one thing we didn't do is we didn't buy iPod photos for everybody or video iPods. And that was something that people were experimenting with at the time. Sort of 2004 was the iPod photo. And then 2005 was the 5th generation iPod that played video, which I had one and I loved, and I loved watching video on it. But I remember looking at that in school and thinking, what can I do with that in school? How could we use that to serve students and be a useful device for students? And we couldn't really quite think of a way, because we weren't kind of lecture based. And I mean, some of the universities did adopt, they didn't necessarily go one-to-one with the iPod, but they did format their content in such a way that could be consumed on that device. And that was, of course, the birth of iTunes U. Was that the original iTunes U was basically just playlists of videos and audio recordings of lectures from the big universities that people could download to their iPods and then listen to around campus. So we looked at that, we evaluated it, we thought about it, but it just didn't seem the right thing for a K-12 school rather than a university. So we left that one behind.
The thing I would say about that is, if you want to talk about anything that was a consumption device, mm-hmm. it was that.
Yeah. 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 But then so are books and so is the library, and nobody complains about them, right?
Right.
You know, content consumption is a fundamental part of learning, right? It's and essentially, until quite recently, it has been more or less the main thing that ever happened in learning, certainly at university level. The other big thing that was red hot at the time in that kind of era, 2005, was virtual learning environments, or learning management systems, as some people call them in the US. And this, the pressure for this came out of, in England, it was from the Building Schools for the Future program, and the Labour government basically decreed that by 2010, every school in England had to have a virtual learning environment set up.
And so is this things like Blackboard and Moodle and that sort of thing?
Yep. Okay. Yep. I mean, Moodle was the kind of number one. There are some others for the sort of K-12 stage, but you've got Blackboard, Canvas, Moodle is a big one. Pearson, of course, have got their toe in the water there as well.
It was a long time ago, but you're talking to a former Blackboard administrator.
Yeah, my sympathies for you.
I've gotten over it. It was a while ago.
Yeah, and in the meantime, in Scotland, what was happening was that the Scottish government were providing this system called GLOW, which was a kind of national virtual learning environment that every school and every local authority and every pupil and indeed at one point every parent was supposed to have a login for. And that system has kind of rolled on, has never quite achieved, I'm putting that too mildly, it absolutely has not achieved the critical mass that it was envisioned to back in, I mean, it was first mooted, I think, in 2002. And you know, here we are, what, 13, 14 years later, and it has not achieved the critical mass that it was supposed to have had. And I think one of my criticisms of virtual learning environments as a concept is that unless you provide enough device access in the classroom, then any virtual learning environment, whether a school-provided one or a nationally-provided one, becomes a really fancy and expensive way to set and collect homework. Because that's home is the only place where pupils have enough access to computers that it actually can impact the activities that they do in school. So that was something that we looked at, and I certainly installed Moodle at one point, played about with it, but it just did not appeal as a fundamental strategy for the school. So we left that one behind as well.
It probably also works better in a distributed remote learning, because mm-hmm. if you're having actual in-class discussions, there's not much need for threaded discussion or
and I think there's somewhere else where
there's still quizzes and stuff.
Work better. There's the automatic marking part, which is appealing to teachers who have to get through 150 to 200 pupils a week, and I completely understand that aspect of it. But also, if you're in a school of 2,000 pupils, you might have five higher classes, and providing an online space for five classes to talk to each other might actually produce some very fertile discussions and a lot of good and valuable learning. Mm-hmm. It's just that is not the situation that Cedar School was ever in and is not in at the moment. So because we didn't have that problem of having to join multiple classes at the same level in some virtual system, then that was another reason not to do that. And I think, to go back to a theme that we've talked about before in this show, that one of the things that's really important is that the specific stack of technologies that you glue together and deploy in your situation must be tailored to your situation. You know, it would be insane for us to go down the line of installing Canvas or something like that for classes of 6 and 8 and 10 pupils at different times. And just because other schools are doing it, and it's always been a bit of my mantra, just because other people are doing it doesn't mean I'm going to do it. Just because other people are doing that, there's no way that I was going to commit the school to doing X, Y, or Z just because everybody thought it was a good idea.
Well, that's also your Scottish stubbornness showing there too.
A little bit. there were other things that came and went. 2006 to 2008 was kind of the heyday of games consoles in school. That was a thing. Games-based learning was very popular in Scotland. At that point, there was a whole... I can't quite remember the name, but there was a kind of place you could go to that schools could like borrow and check out, literally games consoles, Xboxes and Nintendo DS and things like that to do projects with in school. And it's interesting that in the iPad era now, that kind of using computer games in the classroom has actually sort of naturally fallen out of going one-to-one in a way that we decided not to adopt it directly in the classroom as a thing by itself, if you like. So that was something we kind of passed over a little bit as well. And then the other thing that was hot, sort of 2008, 2009, was podcasting studios. And I remember talking to some schools who had spent astronomical amounts of money on, like, literally tens of thousands of pounds on portable podcasting studios, little radio stations that they could move around from classroom to classroom. And that was, you remember when podcasting was hot the first time, you know, and now it's hot again.
Well, I remember when it got added to iTunes in like 4.7 or something like that. And that was, and it was hot kind of before that. And iTunes was a little late to the game.
Yes, it was. Yeah. I mean, it was nothing like what it is now. I mean, it wasn't, in no way was it as mainstream. You didn't have the BBC publishing podcasts, for example. But I remember, did you remember the first time you ever heard about podcasting?
Not especially. Not distinctly.
I could take you to exactly where I was when I heard about this, which was, and I initially made fun of podcasting. I thought it was stupid. But
and here we are.
And here we are, yeah, and the podcasting has taken
over. Episode 138.
I know. But I was at the O'Reilly macOS 10 conference in Santa Clara, and Brent Simmons of NewsWire fame and later the Vesper, the John Gruber app, if you like. sorry, Brent. Brent Simmons gave a talk at that conference about podcasting, because he was, of course, making NewsWire at the time, which was the premier RSS app on the Mac, was then, and probably, as far as I'm concerned, may still be. And he talked about podcasting as an extension of RSS. And he was describing some of the kind of early podcasts, you know, the Adam Curry podcast, and I can't remember what else was even available back then. That was 2004, so podcasting's been around a while.
Right. That's funny that you found it silly, because you were the guy who came up with the idea of appcasts.
Yeah, that was something that it's a bit of my history that many people don't know. But appcasting was an idea where to take the idea. This is before any app store had ever been invented. How to deal with sending updates to existing installed Mac apps. And the idea was essentially an extension of the RSS spec that would enable you to send an enclosure with the RSS feed, which was the download for the new version of the app. Right? And I basically wrote about it on a web page and didn't do anything else about it.
I've actually just found your live journal post from when you... and you end it with the words, "Just a thought."
Yeah, just a thought. I mean, that idea actually did become the de facto standard way of sending out software updates to indie Mac apps before the app stores were invented. And many, many apps still use that exact technique today, which is, so that's a small claim to fame that I have as well.
Right.
And then, of course, the one thing that we definitely didn't do, which I think was one of the reasons why we caught a lot of heat in the early days of the iPad deployment, was in fact netbooks. Right? And netbooks were red hot. And I remember personally being quite enthused about netbooks. And I distinctly remember writing, it wasn't a LiveJournal post by this point, it was probably a tweet that said that, you know, the future belongs to sub £250 devices. And I still think ultimately that's true. But we had Asus EPC machines. We had Dell Mini 9 machines. I had a Hackintosh Dell Mini 9, which I still use to this day to demonstrate taking apart the internals of a computer to classes. It doesn't run anymore. I've ruined it. Mm-hmm. But we evaluated netbooks through and through, up and down in every way we could, and decided ultimately that they weren't as interesting as they purported to be, apart from the cost. And Steve Jobs said exactly that at the launch of the iPad, was that there was nothing interesting about a netbook apart from the price. They're just cheap laptops. And so they were, and they were not good laptops either. The Dell Mini 9 was probably the best netbook ever made, and even that wasn't that good by comparison. So, and then I guess the other thing that we didn't do is we didn't do the iPad Mini. That was one opportunity we had in 2013, was to switch from full-size iPad to iPad Mini, and we didn't do that either. So, That's the alternate history of Cedars Technology is those are all the things we didn't do. That's the parallel world in which we were video iPods and games consoles and podcasters and netbook users. But we didn't do any of that.
Yeah, as an iPad Mini user, I mean, maybe it works better with younger people. I would say that the worst thing about the iPad Mini is actually reading.
Mm-hmm.
Is having to blow up the text because the pixels are so small.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I'm 37 with glasses, so.
Yeah, we're not as young as the kids we teach. Yeah,
right.
I mean, I was always skeptical of the Mini from a motor skills point of view. I slightly suspect I might have over-egged that in the past because, every kid in school who's got their own iPad has got a Mini, right? Almost nobody's got a full-size iPad, and they all seem to get along just fine with them. So, I don't think it's probably not as big a deal as I thought it was. But one of the reasons we didn't go Mini for half the school or something is because in a smaller environment like ours, whatever division of pupils we make to get Mini and full size, that division would be different the next year, and it's very hard to manage the numbers over the course of a deployment if you have two different devices for two different groups, when those groups might change in size over time. Tell you about the final sponsor of the night. This is a new sponsor to the show, and we're really glad to welcome them to the show. It's XMA. XMA and the HP Chromebook 11 and Chromebook 14. Chromebooks have instant on, security built in, long battery life, the best of Google, and access to thousands of educator-approved apps in the Chrome Web Store. XMA brings over 30 years' experience in the UK education market to their All Learn program, which is a proven framework for deploying devices in education that covers everything from planning, cultural impact and finance options, to infrastructure and management. Working with XMA as an HP partner means you get a choice of great Chromebook devices from HP and all the support you need directly from XMA. You can see their offerings at xma.co.uk, or you can follow them on Twitter at @WeAreXMA. Thanks to XMA and the HP Chromebook for supporting Out of School.
So you're looking at 2016. You'll be doing your third deployment, your third one-to-one deployment.
Yep.
What are your factors as you look at that?
What are my factors? My factors are primarily, up until WWDC, my factors were primarily storage capacity and performance and cost. But now my main factor, my overriding factor, I think, is compatibility with iOS 9 multitasking. And depending on what happens this September, because we're always buying now for schools 6 months behind the market in the sense that Apple refreshes in September, October for iPads, and then we sign a contract in May probably or June for devices to be delivered the following August, just 2 months before they become obsolete. So, bring back the spring iPads, from iPad 1 and iPad 2 days, if you ask me. But I think that iOS 9 multitasking is going to be an absolutely massive factor for schools that are heavily into the iOS world.
Right. Because you had previously said that the iPad Air was too good or too expensive with no benefit for schools, and now iOS 9 just turns that on its ear.
Absolutely does. Yeah, no question about it. But I think the iPad Air 2 has always looked like an overpowered device for what it was being asked to do by the software that was available for it up till now. And suddenly now you see with iOS 9, you see why it is the way it is. Right, why it's got 3 cores and 2 gigs of RAM in a world where every other device, the vast majority of devices running the software platform, do not have anything like that capability. They've got 2 cores usually and 1 gigabyte of RAM. And it's quite clear why the side-by-side multitasking only works on the iPad Air 2, and it's straightforwardly just because of that additional processor core and also that double RAM. So now you start to understand why it's going to happen.
Yeah, there also seemed to be a time in PC history where the machine specs were running away faster than the software. Mm-hmm. And we were, when we were ramping up to 3 gigahertz and, running Windows XP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, why bother with that?
And it's, yeah. And so we'll see. Mm-hmm. So you have a note here that says you don't like the Apple TV anymore, or that you think you're not going to be redeploying that.
Yeah, so this is something that's kind of happened over the past year to 2 years, is that the reliability of airplane mirroring seems to have gone through the floor. And this is becoming a real problem for us. And we've tried many of the tricks that are available to it, such as putting the Apple TV device itself on Ethernet rather than on Wi-Fi, which has helped a little bit. But there just seems to be persistent fundamental bugs with the AirPlay mirroring stack in iOS 7 was terrible, and 8 until 8.3 has been pretty bad as well. And a lot of staff are starting to get pretty unhappy with it. So it's possible that I may have a stack of used Apple TVs for sale as well over the summer. But the thing that annoys me most with the Apple TV situation is that I feel like I'm now back in the same situation I was with interactive whiteboards like 10 years ago, which is that the software's gone crappy and nobody will fix it for me. And there's nothing I can do about it, you know. And the length of time we've been waiting for reliability fixes for AirPlay mirroring is just driving people insane right now. Which is kind of a shame, because you think if you go to any Apple education event, they position Apple TV as an absolutely fundamental part of a classroom iPad deployment. And, you know, it just doesn't have the reliability that we look for in classroom hardware or software at all. It simply doesn't. Chromecast is way better. Way better. I actually have one of each in my classroom. Same network, same place. Apple TV, yeah. Poor Chromecast, rock solid.
And this is a wireless Chromecast?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Chromecast is even on the Wi-Fi, and the Apple TV is not. So if I want to watch YouTube videos in class, I will always switch to my Chromecast and use that, because it's completely reliable and the Apple TV is not. I love my Chromecast. Yep. Google Slides is also going to support for Chromecast now as well, which is quite cool. That's not super fast.
Ah, so presentations.
Yeah, too bad it doesn't have support for charts. Yeah, so, I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about the kind of the prehistory of Cedars as well, and some of the kind of early things. You know, you were talking about macOS 10 server in previous versions, and I have the scars from the very early versions of OS 10 server. You know, when the school started in 1999, I was the sysadmin in a kind of voluntary capacity at the time to help get the school off the ground. And mm-hmm. one of the first decisions I made was that we were going to have a common desktop login system and a file server. And at the time, the choice was between, you could basically get the same Mac, which was a blue and white G3, 350 megahertz. And you could either get it with AppleShare IP6, if you remember that.
Yes.
Or you could get it, I mean, nobody remembers AppleShare IP, thankfully, anymore. But you could either get it with that, or you could get it with macOS 10 Server 1.0, which was literally like Rhapsody, literally the next step operating system with the Mac Platinum, macOS 8 Platinum Windows style just laid over the top of it. Yeah. And it still had the WHARF, and it had different things. Or what was it called? It was called the WHARF in next step, wasn't it, I think? Very, very, very next steppy. Even the scroll bars were on the left-hand side of the content instead of the right-hand side. So it was that was how next step it was. But we ran that, and it ran NetBoot and login services for macOS 9 iMacs in the school. And that was something that we were very early into that, and having a shared printer and things as well connected to the server was another thing that we did. And this was in an era when most schools still, you know, their way of multitasking or multi-user on a computer was to have a PC on a trolley with a box of floppy disks beside it. And that was the multi-user scenario. That was what I was like when I was at school as well. So that was early on, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, when I was at school, we were a bit ahead of the game on the lab front, and so this was about 1990, and we had a network lab, one of which ran 10Base2 Ethernet, and another network lab that ran LocalTalk.
Oh yes,
which ran, I think, 250 kilobits. If I'm remembering correctly, it was really really slow.
Yeah, that was. So in speaking of things that were really, really slow, the next year, that was 1999, the next year we put in an ISDN connection to the school. that was considered to be absolutely, you know, rip-roaring top speed. We had also put in Wi-Fi at that point. You know, just we had one of the graphite Apple base stations, You remember the one that had a modem built into the Wi-Fi as well? And when you try to access internet, it would bring up the modem and connect your network to the internet. We had that for a while. I can't honestly remember if we had any computers that had Wi-Fi, but we had a Wi-Fi base station.
Because in those days, the airport was an optional extra on the models on which it was available.
Yeah, you had to buy the airport card. And true story, I bought my first airport card at the Apple store in Littleton, Colorado, back in the day. Yep. That was my first ever visit to any Apple store in the world was the one in Littleton, not too far from you.
Yep.
And what was I going to say about that? Yeah, I think if I remember rightly, now that I think about it, the reason we had the Wi-Fi base station, the airport, the Graphite Airport, was because it had an Ethernet port in it as well, and this was a way that we could do temporary dial-up connections to the internet. So even though we didn't have any Wi-Fi computers, when internet traffic came from the wired network through the Apple base station, it would dial up to the internet for us and then drop the internet connection when we were done with it. So I'm pretty sure that was all we used it for at the time, actually. So that was 2000.
On-demand networking.
Yeah, on-demand networking. Yeah, that was the 2000s. Next thing I remember was 2005. I should have written down the history of this earlier, but that was when we moved to the current building that we were in, and I started working there permanently in 2006. And that was when I started there, my first job in the building was to kit out a new lab with completely new hardware, because at that point we still had those blue and white server and the colored iMac from 1999. And we went for we had the first generation Intel iMacs. The white plastic ones that looked like the iMac G5, but they had Intel chips inside them. And we went Xserve as well. So we had an Xserve running a Mac OS X network. I can't remember if that was when we transitioned to OS X. I think it probably was. We might even have been using Mac OS 9 up to that point. And then we also upgraded to 5 megabit DSL. So that was us hot stuff in 2005.
Well, you certainly needed to have OS X by that point, given all the hardware you described. So.
Yeah, things were getting old looking at that point. And I kind of feel like I felt very nervous at the time. I remember about going for the first generation Intel Mac and being really terrified about it. But to be honest with you, you know, of all the transitions Apple has ever executed in its history, that one was just completely flawless. And I think it was, in some ways, it was like the crowning achievement of Apple software engineering before or since, apart from maybe shipping the original Mac, was to transition from PowerPC to Intel with basically absolutely no issues that a user would perceive.
Yeah, and the big win, it seems, in the long run.
Yep. In the long run, you know, who can say that wasn't the boldest, bravest, and most important thing that Apple did before the iPhone, probably. So yeah, that was us 2005, 2008, whole school Wi-Fi for the first time. And our building is an old building, it's 150 years old, so it was a hell of a learning curve for me to put Wi-Fi into a building that had stone walls 2 and 3 feet thick at points. But we've got it tuned quite nicely now. And we also had a mobile lab of laptops at that point. So we had 12 MacBooks in 2 Pelican cases that could roll around the school and go to different classrooms. And that was kind of the seed of what eventually became the iPad deployment, I think, because one of the things that, you know, 2 years later when we come to do iPad, one of the metrics that kind of made me think about that was I asked teachers, well, what do you do when you take the Mac into your classroom? What do you do with the Mac? And they all said, we use the word processor and we go on the web. And then I thought, mm-hmm. Well, if that's all we do with the computer, why do I need to deliver such a powerful and capable computer just to do those two things? And that was what started me down the path of looking at things like iPod Touch. And then we were kind of in the way of looking for something lighter and smaller than a laptop when the iPad came out. You remember the iPad launch of Steve Jobs? He said, you know, we've all got our smartphone, we've all got our laptop, but wouldn't it be great if there was something that was as easy to use as a smartphone and thinner and lighter with longer battery and easier to use than the laptop? And I was watching that going, yes, that's exactly what I've been looking for 6 to 8 months now, is exactly that device, right? Smartphone, mobile OS, lightweight, long-time battery.
And you've told this story before, but the four people that caught you between the door and your classroom,
yep,
they had also seen, you know, either the presentation or on the news or something, saying, mm-hmm. isn't this what we've been waiting for?
Yeah. So we were very much in the way of looking for that kind of device before that device shipped. And I think it was, you know, one of the things that was really convincing about the iPad to me, even on that first day, was that the idea that the iPad was just a big phone was so obviously wrong even from the first day, because a huge part of the keynote was keynote itself, Pages and Numbers from the Mac being taken mobile on the iPad, and mm-hmm. those were not phone apps made large. Those were actually Mac apps made portable, and that was even on the first day. That was why it was so obviously not a correct analysis that this is just a big iPhone. In fact, it was almost like a small Mac, and I feel like we've kind of gone through the trough of disillusionment with the iPad, and we're hopefully coming out the other side of that now with iOS 9. To see some real productivity applications like that come along. I mean, there's obviously been a lot of change since then. You know, we could talk all day about what has happened since 2010. You know, there's technology out the wazoo. You know, the way that we deploy iOS today compared to the way I deployed iOS in 2010 is just night and day in terms of the amount of downtime that is no longer required, the amount of walking around the school and carrying devices here and there that's not required anymore. It's come a long way, and although there's plenty I want it to do in the future and with iOS 9 and beyond, what I'm able to do today and how fast I'm able to do it is so much greater than what it was back in the day that it's almost like a different device.
All right.
Yeah, so there's the prehistory of Cedars and the backstory and the things that we didn't do. I think that's we're trying to think what else we're not doing at the moment. We're probably not doing Chromebook is one thing, you know.
Really? Because you are fond of it.
Mm-hmm.
And getting more fond of it.
I'm getting more fond of it, and I feel like I now completely understand why schools would go Chromebook, and. You know, Bradley just last week talked about he's put 10 desktop Chrome devices into his library and is completely in love with them. And from a sysadmin point of view, I completely understand it. I just feel, and I'm with my sysadmin hat on, I would love to go Chromebook because it's way easier to deploy Chromebook than it is to deploy iOS now. However, I think us having been a school that is one-to-one iPad, to then switch from that to Chromebook would require such a radical rethinking of everything we do, and in many cases a step backwards. Whereas a school that's coming to one-to-one for the first time, I think Apple's got a lot of work to do to convince people to go iOS instead of Chromebook. So I think it depends more where you're coming from than the absolute benefits of either platform, because there's a lot of good in Chromebook, but I really feel you have to build your school and your processes around Google Docs. Whereas we're quite used to some of the other things that we do in iOS, you know, many of the art applications and the movie making and things that are quite difficult in Chrome OS, those are now such a part of our school that to take that all away would be a very, very hard sell, not just to the students, but actually to the teachers now. Yeah. Still, this episode is sponsored by Chromebook, so I think I've changed my mind on Chromebook in many different ways, and I think that one of them is that I used to think that the schools who were going Chromebook out of conservatism and ignorance. And that's clearly not the case. And with the newer Chromebooks and the faster Chromebooks and the more powerful management features that they've got, and of course, frankly, Docs and Drive getting so much more powerful, and I'm a big user of that in my own work and personal life as well, that there are plenty of good reasons to go Chromebook. And particularly to go upwards to Chromebook from nothing or from very little is a perfectly logical step. And I now understand why a lot of schools do that, and it makes a ton of sense to me. If I was in their shoes, I would probably be doing exactly the same thing.
So if you're going one-to-one from nothing or two-to-one or mm-hmm. 6-to-1 or something, then it makes more sense than going from one-to-one iPad, which is where you are today.
Yeah, I think so. And I can see all kinds of good arguments for doing – there's good arguments for doing both platforms now. And I think it's Bradley and I finished our show recently talking about this, where we just said it's great to have options, isn't it? And I think finally Apple has got some real serious competition in the education space for a different kind of one-to-one device and different kind of one-to-one platform. And I hope that spurs both companies on to greater things.
All right.
Great. Well, thank you for interviewing me.
thank you for you know, filling it out.
Right, well, people are always bugging us for a longer show, and I think we've delivered them exactly that this week. So
that is true.
Yes, we will. We have gone longer than long. But thank you very much for coming on, Fraser. Really appreciate it.
So we should go back to the top and make a comment about short show this week or something.
Yeah, I'll patch that in later on. Not much to talk about this week. Just massive security vulnerabilities, caching server, and the entire history of my career. Or at least part of it. Great. Well, Fraser, we'll talk again, I'm sure. But thanks very much for coming on the show this week.
I would hope so. Thank you.
Cheers.